evening, friends and fellow lovers of all things edible. Whether it be the three-star restaurant or hole-in-the-wall, sous vide steak or can of spam. You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio. I'm Paolo Espanola, and welcome to episode 4. If you want to find more information about what we do and what Hidden Apron is, check us out, hiddenapron.com. For your food porn needs, we're also on Instagram at hidden_apron. And just because we don't get enough email, hit us up, hiddenapron@gmail.com. Now, if you'll notice, today's format will be a little bit different. It will be the first of our commentary episodes that will alternate releases with our usual interviews. During these much shorter episodes, I'll be summarizing recent news in the food world or diving deep on a specific topic. You know, especially even my own experience, I think information overload is a much bigger problem today than the lack thereof. So hopefully these commute-friendly releases will give you a few more things to chew on, pun fully intended, and keep abreast of what's cooking. I will stop with the puns now. So the way I see it, it's just a way for you to have to deal with the deluge of information out there a little bit less, and hopefully I can help with that. So for this first episode, I wanted to share my experiences attending the Just Food Conference this past Sunday, which was held at Columbia University. And it was quite a different experience in that it wasn't a conference endorsed by the usual celebrity chefs or, you know, built for Instagram orgies. Instead, it was a much more intimate affair that had one of the most diverse attendee groups I've ever seen in the few conferences that I've attended, food or otherwise. I mean, in the auditorium, there were high school students, youth organizers, food justice activists, lawyers, urban farmers, and quite a few day jobbers like myself who volunteered their spare time in moving the conversation around food forward. One of the other things that struck me was how, I guess for lack of a better word, thoughtful this conference was. I mean, the food was ethically sourced in a very unpretentious way. You know, they weren't banging you on the head about saying the food was organic or it was sourced from here and here. It was just well sourced. Organizers called for properly recycling and composting the food to ensure that the event was zero waste. You know, the fact that attendees had the option of going to these identity caucuses during lunch. It's basically sessions where people of different identities can congregate and talk about their shared experiences. There was one for LGBTQ, one for women, one for youth. The fact that there was a glossary in the back of the pamphlets and folders that they gave us explaining definitions of words like advocacy and equity. And don't even get me started on the topics of the workshops themselves. I honestly had a hard time picking only two to attend. You know, some of the things I was looking at, there was a workshop on how cities support small businesses that are food related. There was one on how do you detox your liver. There was one on integrating school gardens into the curriculum. There was one on growing food and climate change. One on pitch crafting and how do you create the marketing around your new food business. Suffice it to say, there were a ton of topics and I could only pick two. So it was very difficult. But with a name like Just Food Conference, I knew that the content was only going to focus on food, which to me was heaven sent. And it was quite affordable too, I might add. And don't get me wrong, I think there's definitely value and a lot of fun in the more skills-based, trendy workshops. I've taken quite a few of them myself, you know, like how to shoot a beautiful photo for Instagram or how to grow your blogger base. But I think it's the topics that were covered at this conference that deserve a lot more airtime. And it actually forced me to look at and discuss some of the more uncomfortable realities of how we eat and what our relationship with food is like today. So I wanted to share some of the people and topics that really stood out to me. These were, of course, just some of the many change makers who were present, and I'll definitely be looking at the others who I didn't get a chance to see just because they have very interesting stories in the pamphlet. And who knows, we might even get some of the people on the show. So the day actually started with a couple of food talks at the very beginning in a large auditorium where everyone was gathered, and each of them I could hold an episode on their own. They were very inspiring individuals who had very diverse backgrounds, but basically I had three takeaways that I wrote down in my notebook full of notes from those talks. And one of the first ones, and quite an interesting one that I wasn't even aware of despite my frequenting them, is that street food, you know, the guys selling dirty water hot dogs, you know, the halal carts that you seem to see in every corner. It street food is not just a matter of convenience, which I often think it is. You know, I don't have time to cook. I'm on the way home. I just really need something to eat. Or it's 2 a.m. and I've had too much to drink. Therefore, it's convenient. It's not just a matter of that, but it's also quite tied to food justice and access. So one of the speakers who talked about this topic was a guy named Sean Basinski, who runs the Street Vendor Project. He basically spoke of the troubles and the struggles that food vendors face every day. And what was very surprising to me was that not only do vendors have to deal with the sheer physicality of standing all day or fighting through extreme weather during winter or the middle of summer, but they actually have to deal with the government itself. The gist of what he was talking about was that basically ever since the 80s, the cap for the number of licenses that the government allows to be available at any given time, and these street vendors basically need one of these licenses to be legit, right, hasn't been increased. In fact, they were decreased from, I think it was like 12,000 to 3,000. And you can imagine, as a result, people often have to wait for like 15, 20 years to receive a license. And what ends up happening is many of them are actually traded in like a black market of sorts, where licenses can trade up to $25,000 when initially they were just sold at $200 max. Now, arguments about food safety aside, right? Because people will say, okay, well, you really need a license so you know that you're getting it from a safe spot. That aside, the sheer inability for such a system to support hardworking citizens, and a lot of them, you know, depend on these carts for their livelihood, is quite glaring. You know, I think we see the hip side of street food, right? We see it on TV all the time, and even with popular food trucks. I will fully admit, I was one of the regulars that would go to these food trucks parked on 47th Street in New York's Midtown East. You know, I loved seeing them on Twitter, and I loved going to the ones that had really cool menus. But I think what we don't often see are the hundreds of marginalized and underserved vendors who depend on these carts, or, you know, from the consumer side, people who can't afford a kitchen in their house. And so Sean was talking about people he knew that ate all of their meals at these carts because that's the only thing they could afford. So he talked about the campaign that they're running called Lift the Caps, basically asking the government to increase the number of licenses out there. You can learn more about the campaign and other things that Sean's working on streetvendor.org. And by the way, I'll put a lot of these links and a lot of these people, their profiles, I'll put them on the show notes on the site. So that was the first one. The second takeaway that I wrote down was that the youth are integral to solving the issues facing our food. It's not just something that's like feel good, like, oh, you know, my kids are cooking in the kitchen, but they're actually a force to be reckoned with on their own right. So I heard Khalil Anderson of the Rockaway Task Force talk about how he and his crew set up an all-youth, all-volunteer-run farmers market and garden after Superstorm Sandy devastated their community years ago. And their efforts are actually helping address the food deserts of Rockaways, where fresh produce is extremely hard to find, yet there are 10 fast food restaurants that do more harm than help people located within a half mile radius. So I think that term itself has been covered a lot before, food deserts, right? And we see pictures of them out in Detroit, but these are prevalent in many low income communities. And it's really cool to see people who, you know, they're not really getting paid to do this, but they care a lot about the community and are able to provide them with access to healthy food. Third takeaway, and this was, I think, quite potentially the most empowering one that I've heard of how food can be used to both oppress and liberate people. Now, that it's kind of sounds high-minded, right? But bear with me for a sec. So the speaker of it, who was very inspiring, by the way, her name was Leah Penniman, who runs the Soul Fire Farm out in Grafton, New York. She spoke about how issues that surround food are connected, very connected with issues like racism, oppression, and justice, far more than we think. Some of the startling statistics that I found looking up her farm online were that 1 in 10 Black and Latino families are hungry. That's 3 times higher than the rate of that what white families would experience. And that, you know, people in these communities are 5 times more likely to die from poor diets than from violence. And that's something that seems to make sense, but we don't often see that, or we don't often hear about that side of the, you know, low-income communities or communities that have been traditionally oppressed, is because we don't often think of food in the same way we do guns or drugs, right? We see all the news and the headlines covering these two things, but food is really just as powerful, and I would argue it's even more insidious because we often let it slip under our radar, not knowing what effect it has. And so she used this term food apartheid to describe these communities that are disparately impacted by a broken food system. A couple of other interesting facts through her talk, she talked about regenerative farming, which is basically a subset of organic farming in which the goal is to build soil health. It was actually pioneered by an African-American, George Washington Carver, who gets very little credit for his contributions to how organic farming has progressed today. You know, there are a lot of talks about organic farming, and there's a certain vibe that comes with it, but it's been around for a long time and owes a lot to contributions by people like George Washington Carver. Another fun fact, or not so fun actually considering the history, but that a lot of slaves who were taken from Africa actually stored rice and okra seeds in their braids, as they knew that the food was going to be very important for their survival once they arrived here. This is really cool because I remember seeing an episode about this on Mind of a Chef with Sean Brock, where he shows just how much influence the slaves and African culture had on Southern cuisine. One more other thing that I also wrote down was how the concept of a CSA has been around for a very long time. So for those of you who don't know, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Basically, you pay a fee to a farmer or a farm in exchange for regular shares of what's grown on that farm. And, you know, one of my coworkers actually got laughed at having one of these because it's you know, sometimes people see that as, oh, you must be a hipster, or it's this sign of like this hip, trendy lifestyle. But what people don't often realize, and I didn't even know this, is that they've got their roots deep in Black culture. They've been attributed to European or Japanese models, but it was actually first coined or it got its start from what were called clientele membership clubs by another farmer named Booker T. Watley. So suffice it to say, the farm, Soulfire Farm, is quite an inspiring one, as it's got quite an ambitious vision and mission. It basically seeks to use food to end racism and the school to prison pipeline, reconnect people with ancient growing practices, and the list goes on. I think bottom line is this is one really powerful farm, and hopefully one day I'd like to go up there and actually take one of their workshops and learn some of the things they do, because it's definitely something that I haven't seen a lot with a lot of other farms. So after the food talks, we transitioned into workshops. Like I said, there was only two I could pick, so I settled on the first one. It was a workshop called People Power, and it basically focused on helping people who run volunteer organizations. And Hidden Apron is one of them. I consider myself a volunteer of my own organization. And how do you build sustainable groups that are more resistant to burnout and turnover? So during the workshop ran by Cheryl Durant and Paula Lukacs, we, as a group, we listed out pros and cons of running and working for these volunteer-run organizations, and some solutions for common problems, right? Such as, again, turnover, retention, how do you recruit the right people? And one of the things that was mentioned multiple times by a lot of the breakout groups was the need to celebrate and appreciate volunteers, even more than recruiting and engagement. It was really this, like, you know, the need to make sure volunteers not only have their skills and passions aligned with the organization's needs, but that they should be appreciated and they should feel comfortable in voicing their opinions, even if it's in contradiction to, you know, like if they say we shouldn't really be doing this. Having that comfort is key to long-term success. So one example was a gentleman from City Harvest was there, and he talked about how his organization invited volunteers to free movie screenings, and they really felt that was a way that made volunteers feel appreciated, even though it wasn't like a monetary compensation. I think it's something that I myself often forget to do in the heat of a moment or right after dinner when you're just completely exhausted. So if anyone from the growing crew is listening, know that Hidden Apron would not be here if it weren't for you guys and gals bringing your own stories to dinners and collaborations. And even the diners, you know, you guys really do deserve a lot of the credit for why we're even around today and why we keep doing what we're doing. So one of an interesting acronym that one of the attendees brought up that kind of highlighted the important life cycle for a volunteer and showed where appreciation fits in was ROSES, R-O-S-E-S. So that stood for recruit, orient, support, evaluate, and most importantly, salute. I just thought it was a cool way to think about these volunteer-run organizations and not forgetting to salute your volunteers. People brought up several organizations, and again, I'll put the links in the show notes that basically connect nonprofit organizations with highly skilled professionals who could donate their time and skills that are more than just manual labor, right? Whether it's financial planning, tax consultation, etc. Some of those that were mentioned were SCORES, ReServe, Taproot Plus. You guys might want to check them out if you're running organizations that heavily rely on the goodwill of volunteers. And I actually shared my own personal experiences with Hidden Apron itself at the workshop. One thing that I found particularly helpful, and I think is a credit to how we've managed to, I guess, stay alive for the short time we've been here, is how we frame asking for help and our approach on that. And we think that rather than calling for volunteers, right, we change how we frame that, and we actually raise the profile of the contributor to something more like a partner. And so this has helped us find new cooks in the form of diners who we actually invite to share their skills and stories at future dinners. So rather than asking for like, oh, would you be a volunteer chef? We pitch it as an opportunity to share personal stories through food. It's helped tons. So bottom line, changing the way you ask for help. For the second workshop, I dropped in on a panel that covered how several change makers were rethinking impact investing, economic development, and other strategies that work food into a more holistic community that was both healthy and equitable. This was, and you could tell I totally wrote that down. And even for me, it was quite a heady, very cerebral workshop that I had to continuously like retype my notes, because the topics took a very broad macro look at the role of food and culture and how it, you know, shapes our lives. This really opened my eyes to just how powerful a well-thought-out integrated system is, and how the local food movement is more than just using local ingredients. One of the speakers, Jessica Norwood, who works over at Emerging Changemakers, you know, shared how it should also mean considering what the local culture is built on, you know, and who lives in that community. It's not just about the ingredients, and ensuring that the local residents are served by whatever enterprise you create, whether it's a hole in the wall or an upscale juice bar cafe. I think this affects a lot more of those quickly growing, I think the term that you often hear is gentrification, right? Some new coffee shop opens or a new organic grocery that is priced way above the means of the local residents, and they get priced out of their own neighborhood. Again, it's really easy for us to cherry pick what we like about the trendier aspects of food. So whether that's, you know, supporting the local gluten-free bakery, buying wholesome ingredients from the organic bodega, getting our daily cleanse from the hip juice bar, I think there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But too often we, including myself, forget who came here first and how our consumption habits affect everyone along the entire food chain, from the farmer who grew the food to the distributor, to the, you know, the person who works the cashier spot, to ultimately us. So those are pretty much it. The conference ended with a very heartfelt talk by six very strong-willed women who cooperatively ran the Rise and Root Farm in Orange County, New York. That was another thing, by the way, is that a lot of the attendees were women of color. It was one that I found very inspiring, and I think one of the statistics that an attendee shared, or one of the panelists shared, was that of the new food businesses growing up that were starting in her community, and I think it was in Detroit, 70% of them were owned by women, And of that 70%, 60% were by women of color. So it's really something that put a smile on my face. It's quite uplifting to hear statistics like that. So at the end of the day, it was a Sunday and it started quite early. I basically left there physically exhausted. I was mentally drained. But man, I am telling you, I'm really glad that this conference popped up on my Facebook feed. I saw that one of my friends was interested in going. So you see, food really does underpin most of our lives. It's what unites us if done right, and we could do a lot more to make it right, and affects more than just us feeling hungry. As the conference made clear to me, it affects everything from housing justice, whether you're able to afford an apartment with a kitchen in it, climate change, obviously a very meat-heavy diet does have an effect on the climate, racism, self-empowerment, all of these topics and much more can be traced to the things we choose to grow, buy, prepare, and ultimately eat. And so as I walked out and made the long trek back to Queens, I realized that the name of the conference, Just Food, didn't only cover the fact that the focus was on the food, as in just the food, but specifically just as in right or appropriate, you know, like he is just, or, you know, the root of justice, just food. And how do we create more just societies? So that aha moment hit me on the train, and I'll definitely be returning to the conference next year if I get a chance. And, you know, I would encourage everyone to check out the links. I think there are some really cool, very unique stories from the people who ran and participated in the conference. And that is basically it. I hope that you guys like this shorter format. Do leave us feedback if you'd prefer to see more of these, or you'd think, you know what, Paolo, just shut up, keep it at the interviews. Hey, that's cool too. Anyway, till the next episode, thanks for listening.